So welcome everybody to the Doomer Optimism podcast. I am here today with John Dios, somebody I think many of our audience got into a massive fight with maybe a year ago. I don't know how long ago that was. So you might love him, you might hate him, but he's here and we're going to chat. So John, let you introduce yourself first and then we'll get into it.
So I'm basically just a regular guy from New England, I like to think. I don't think I really have any kind of credentials or anything of note. I work for a Catholic nonprofit. Before that, I was just a chef, mostly working banquets. I happen to be from the eastern part of Connecticut, which is more rural. My family's pretty blue collar. I probably am, most people would know me because I kind of accidentally fell into these homesteading wars on Twitter, which I think was mostly just kind of me having fun with Neil, who I'm sure everybody knows.
Are you also like adjacent somewhat to like, I don't know, right wing Twitter? Like there's, we can start getting into that, but like.
Yeah. So I came into Twitter originally, I was running a sports blog in like 2014. That was very focused on very local stuff. I was, into like Hartford's historical hockey and the college teams and that kind of stuff. And it had nothing to do with politics. And then 2016 happened. And so I was in the middle of this during the election and I just started commenting on stuff as it happened. And then I kind of got sucked in this whole other realm. I got exiled from sports writing because I didn't immediately think that it was a bad thing when Trump happened. And as soon as he won, it was like, okay, now it's not funny anymore. You got to take a side. And I didn't. I said, I voted for the guy. I wasn't ashamed of it. I wasn't angry at people who didn't, but it became very divisive right away. And so at that time, you really couldn't be anywhere else if you felt that way. It was, you were right wing or you were with all of everybody else.
Yeah. So, yeah. So and it was like, you couldn't even say, I mean, there were things you couldn't even say. I was totally I wasn't on Twitter at all at that time, but that was definitely a crazy period where it was like, you couldn't even acknowledge that Trump was right on anything. Like you couldn't even acknowledge that if he ever said a correct statement, you couldn't acknowledge it.
My background, most, if you're Catholic and from New England, or especially if you're blue collar, you just voted Democrat because that's like the pro-labor thing.
Yeah.
A lot of us by around 2000 had just stopped voting. And I was one of those people. I don't think I ever voted in any election other than for local stuff until Trump. And a lot of it was just, the excitement was not necessarily, I didn't feel like it was especially right wing, at least back in 2016. It was very ill-defined. It was just like, something's happening that's not supposed to happen. This guy's not supposed to be a candidate. They don't want this to happen. You can actually vote. Like if people who don't vote show up, this will happen and they can't stop it and it's going to be crazy. And that was a lot of what the excitement was about. And then it took a dark turn on both sides after it set in that it was real, because a lot of people didn't think it would happen. And so at that point, I was doing sports writing. I was getting, I kept my day job, but I was getting a fair amount of attention. I got invited on the local NPR affiliate and that just stuff stopped. It was like, you're done, you're dead, blocked. Deep unpersoned, people stopped associating with me. So then I just kind of fell into there and I started doing these projects. A lot of stuff that evolved into the Holy Agony was just me kind of, doing weird folk art. And I ran the Tradwave project for a while. And then I started doing music and eventually that led me into the podcast thing.
Okay. So maybe we'll like start with this most recent fight and then maybe work backwards. Cause I'm really curious about, I don't know. I just feel like it's not actually that esoteric what happens on Twitter. I think it actually seeps in to what's happening in the wider world. And like the right wing stuff is really, I don't know, all of it, all of these esoteric like little movements are really, I think, interesting and indicative of larger things. So I think it's worth talking about. Okay. So let's, I'll welcome Willow briefly, or I'll just acknowledge that she's popping in. Willow is going to join us too for this conversation, and apparently her baby is asleep, so she can join us, so that's good. So let's just start with like this anime avatar fight you and Neil had. I was like kind of watching from the sidelines, like, who are these people? And I had this sense that like Neil at least kind of like associate or at least thought that they were like maybe worth associating with, a lot of these people, and then kind of got disillusioned during that fight. So let's talk about that.
Well, there's been kind of, since 2016, it very slowly bifurcated, where there was this very kind of like dour humor, was very current events, 24/7 politics. And that's a lot of the stuff you see, I think, that gets very political and dark, just from people being stuck in that feedback loop. And it's like, you know, probably most people, if you went down a list of policy positions and I said what I think, I mean, most people probably think I'm pretty right wing, but I don't feel like I have a lot of energy about it. I'm not angry at any other, you know, other people. I'm not bitter about other groups. I don't walk around really thinking about it. I don't follow the news, but a lot of people, especially when they were primarily engaging it online, they couldn't talk about it in real life, get sucked into these cultures. And I think you started seeing a divide where there would be people who were basically living in their day-to-day life, like, you know, a standard urban, you know, blue state life, with all this private stuff going on. And the only way outlet they had for it is these memes and these weird subcultures. And where we are different is we're kind of popping in while we're living our lives. And Twitter is very egalitarian that way. I can be out there digging a hole outside and I get tired, I can pull out my phone and tweet for 2 minutes and go back to digging. I can be at work and I throw something in the oven, I got 5 minutes to pull it out, so I stay in there and tweet for 5 minutes. So we're all in the same space with the same access, living very different lives and engaging in different ways. So there started to be a disconnect, I think, with guys who were, where this stuff was more about, you know, it was tied into their real lives and had concrete in a way that it wasn't for guys who were very into the meme stuff. So when you would start pushing back, you know, they get very defensive. And that was really, I think, the core of it. I think there was, if I had to get into the specifics, it was Scott Greer posted something to the effect of, if you, you know, you rural homesteaders are LARPers too, you shouldn't care if blue state conservatives want to move to your small town because you don't have any culture anyways. And the phrase Walmart and Mudden, that's your culture. So, and we kind of, you know, we're kind of jerks and we poke fun at them, and that's what we do. And from my understanding, from people who were friendly with both sides, who talked to me later, so that kind of struck a nerve and they were irritated us. So then a week later, whatever set them off, and then it just, you know, they started just directing people our way for like a solid week straight. And we really got, you know, we got beat up in the fight. That's
yeah, I saw that. And it was like a swarm, a real swarm on you guys. That was crazy. And I want to get like deeper into the content of it. But first I just want to say hi to Willow and,
hi.
Hello. I don't know if you followed at all this fight between John and Neil and like the anime avatar groups.
I didn't know it was the anime avatar. Neil calls a lot of people in the anime avatar groups. I'm never sure exactly who he's talking.
Yes. I guess I just want to know more from John. Like, what is your sense of these people who are like fighting back with you? There was something about the one thing that like was popping out when I was reading it was like this sense that these guys, these anonymous guys, are in some kind of like epic battle in their own minds. Yeah.
For people listening, do you want to just explain the outline of it a bit?
I don't know the outline well enough to
say the argument.
So, like I said, there was that little dust up the week before.
Yeah.
And then that set off, that kind of stewed, and people on that side were irritated with us for about a week. And then it was, I don't remember exactly which tweet set it off. It was something talking about, you know, I think it wasn't even a tweet. It was me responding to Neil. And I said something like these people all want to be Achilles, but no, you know, real heroes are guys who go to work every day and show up.
Yeah.
and are just normal guys who do things that are hard to do every day, because it is hard to wake up at 5 a.m. for 50 years and not quit your job and not walk away from your family. That's hard to do. Well, just because a lot of people do it doesn't mean it wasn't difficult. And that was just a reply in a thread that I tossed off at like 5 a.m. and that thing just got quote tweeted for like 3 days straight. And that was, and then it started attracting. There was a, it really like it set people off in an ugly way.
I think I don't know if this was the follow-up or the first one, but I think it was the Mishima tweet.
Yeah, it was in there. It was, I don't have it in front of me, but I did say it was, that like BAP and that were all, it was all just kind of like a make-believe thing. It was it was a way to externalize that stuff because they didn't have it in the real life.
Yeah, I think it's like a way of like a form of I think what Neil is basically saying, like you're trying to escape into a fantasy instead of like showing up for your daily life that is like, and the people who actually need you in your daily life. And
Yeah.
at least that's how I read it. It was like you're glorifying this like past, days of heroic men and glory, but it's like you're not even that. You're not even an ordinary guy who's just like able to like follow through and do like stuff. And it
Yeah,
was,
and
I don't know. I don't know, because I don't know why Neil was saying the anime avatars, because I think it was more like the mainstream right wing slash the right wing Baptists who were kind of
yeah.
like coming. Neil, that's why I say Neil just called everybody anime
Yeah.
avatars. I don't know.
Well,
I
that
don't know if it was actually.
well,
what happened later on, after there was initially, it was more of an open debate between, like the Baptist guys and Scott Greer and his followers. After, later in the week, it just turned into these like weird, it was all just anonymous kids with anime avatars. And it got at that point, it was just kind of ugly personal attacks. And you could tell like stuff was bouncing around group chats and they're like, get this guy, get this guy. And it got to, they're just saying stuff about our kids and your daughters are going to marry black guys and stuff like that. It was all, it got very much into the racial anxiety stuff on that side got like really got ramped up. But I don't think some of the criticisms were unfair. I do think a lot of these guys make this stuff about race because they live in these cities and they don't, they live around this stuff and they don't ever speak up about it except online. And it builds up in their head into this huge thing and they get really worked up about it. And I don't, and it's a fit. They would say to us, well, it's easy to say you live in this place that's 99.9% white, so you can dismiss our concerns. But I work in a city every day. I'm not scared. I'm not even dismissing their concerns out of hand. I just think it doesn't. It that part of the right wing stuff doesn't feel healthy to me at all. I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah, and I think like the other thing that's really maybe we'll get into like the homesteading thing and the Catholic thing, but there's like an extent to which a lot of these anonymous Twitter accounts are like projecting their fantasy, and it's really, I think it can be incredibly unhealthy because these guys, it's like a lot of young guys, or I don't even actually know who's behind a lot of these anonymous accounts, but there's like obviously this like frenzy where everybody gets behind this like Bronze Age pervert guy, for those who are not familiar with what BAP stands for. And it's like, the part of the messaging is like you're part of some like heroic arc. And then what it comes down to in reality is like I don't even actually know what it like what what like what their daily life how their daily life is impacted by like imagining that they're part of some Bronze Age pervert heroic arc.
I think that like I think the BAP followers are kind of like two different kinds. I think that there is a subset of men who have like been genuinely inspired and like used his sort of like energy of like masculine vigor and vitality to like transform their own lives for the better. And I don't want to like I think that they're like I don't want to like only shit on him because I think that, or his like ilk, because I think that there are very few like things that can like activate and like energize young men today. I think it's very hard to do, and I think he has successfully done that. And I think for a group of people, it's been like great. Like I know guys who have like I know like got like through Twitter, but like I know people who have like gotten into shape, like gotten their lives together, and it's actually had like a transform, like got married, and like, and then I think that there's the people who are like use it to kind of justify their like already fucked up social like kind of scene, and like they're just like they just get like twisted around it, and they're like, you know, nowhere close to having functional stuff going on, and so they just sort of like LARP this like I don't know weird fantasy world where they're yeah they're like a hero, but it's like the it's like it says like you know they pick and choose what they want to hear, and then they kind of like just go into this like like Bronze Age pervert says is like take over like he's like it like get into your local governments and like assume positions of power in your local governments, which is like not like a glamorous thing to do. It's like a pretty it's pretty tedious thing to do that like does require basically showing up all the time. But it's like but they just take the like oh go on adventures in Africa and like colonize things whatever and like go I don't know go like take glory and go form like bands of men, and it's like it was like they're not going to do that. It's so far out of reality that they're basically just like using that as like a way to attach themselves to like some vision that they don't end up like acting out in their own life. They don't even take like the next step up, which like Neil's saying is like being just like a functional human who shows up every day and has a job.
Yeah, I do think it's important to make that distinction because a lot of people took it like I was saying, these books are bad, don't read these books. And I own some of those books. I read those books. I have good friends who got a lot out of BAP. I liked BAP, you know, early on. I found it very entertaining, even though I've soured on it now. But I think it's more, there's the second type we're talking about is guys where it becomes a justification for paralysis. So that was really the point we kept making, was that these guys are just, you know, it was just an endless series of excuses why I can't have kids. I'll never own a house. The Great Reset made everything pointless. Demographics, there's no point. The white race is extinct. I'm a white guy. There's no world left for me. And it just turns to this endless, woe is me, why do anything? And it's very convenient to me that the end solution is to just sit on Twitter and demoralize yourself all day long from anonymity.
Yeah, well, there's like there's an energy of like, you know, life is so bad for me. And you're like, I don't care. It's not about you. Like, get over it. Like, just it's like these people do this like cyclical like, oh, it's so hard. It's so hard to be. And you're like, yeah, they're like, yeah, I'm sure like there are real struggles, and I don't want to like, I don't want to like, I don't know, minimize that. But I think that. At the same time, it's not useful to get stuck in this like I'm so special, and like, and I'm also so hard done by, and that's why my life's not together, and it's because of these external forces outside me that are making me that like this is why I'm so fucked up. And you're like, well, partially, like maybe partially, but partially like you're why you're so fucked up. You know, you've gotta kind of I don't know, kind of just start. Like start doing something and get your life together. You can't just hide behind the like, oh, life's hard because I'm white forever. It's very, very lame. It's kind of a self-own too, you know? It's like just get over yourself. I mean it's easy like I know it's I mean I think that to some degree like these people have like actual issues that they're avoiding. Like I don't want to be like they don't have real issues, but like they're using this as like a guise to like never have to actually encounter their actual problems that they have in their real life that
Yeah.
are preventing them from like taking meaningful action. So I don't want to be like, oh, just get over it. I'm just saying like get over the like reason you're giving. Like it's not helping. Nothing's changing. It's not going to do anything about it. Like, you know, shitposting online only goes so far. And it's like, oh, that's nice. You're edgy and racist online. Like, that's, you know, that's very boring.
Yeah, and it reminds me a lot of, and this is another thing I didn't follow super closely, but like those men's groups who are just like incels and hate women and are just like, you know, the whole world is against me and that's why I can't get a woman and this kind of thing. It's like, you know, I don't know. So I think a lot of this is there's like a similar phenomenon if I can like try to pull it together to. like, you know, there are people who are in an unhealthy way thinking that they're part of some, I guess, subjugated subgroup somehow. And then that makes them not able to do anything in real life except for imagine themselves as like part of the subjugated subgroup. And then because of that, they're somehow heroic, or they're like planning something heroic. I guess that's like the planning part that's also kind of lame, where they're just like constantly just talking about some heroic future where they're gonna rise up or something.
And Neil says that they're literally no different than the like left wing, right? It's like, this is why Neil's being like, you guys are the same thing.
Yes.
And they react to things that are legitimately messed up, but their response is to just always just make a mirror image of it that's based. It's like, you know, feminism is toxic, so I'm just going to be a toxic male liberal version. That's really, and it is the same stuff. You know, they sound exactly the same, just with the words replaced.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, I just want to highlight while we're talking about this, Willow, I sent this, your own tweet to you. You know, people are asking, in this one thread of mine, you know, why aren't people even taking the smallest steps to make their lives better? And you said like people don't even want to think they have agency over their own lives. There's a whole subset of the population who thinks they're going to be part of some massive revolution, but in a vague and abstract way. And it reminded me so much of John's tweet, which I also sent to you. When you take personal responsibility for saving the world, obsess over big picture, and politicize your daily life, you get nothing but confusion. Urban transplants miserably living in and ruining small towns, weird, extremely online nerds blackpilling themselves into paralysis. It's like totally exactly what we're talking about now. I'm wondering if you guys have anything more to say on that topic.
Yeah, I mean, the point I was making there was because a lot of people were trying to make a straw man of what we were saying, that we were trying to glorify rural life or say, everyone should just move to the country or that's the solution. I don't think that's the solution. I don't think a guy who's lived in New York City his entire life is going to move to Maine and be happy. I don't think he's going to be functional. I don't think it's going to be good for Maine or him. I don't know what the solution is for New York City because I don't know the particulars because I've never lived there. But, you know, I do know at some point there were neighborhoods that were functional and people had identities and communities and it wasn't the way it is. And so it's within the realm of the possible for New York City to be a livable place. So if you live there, you should start figuring that out. I'm not saying you should come live in my town. I think we both hate each other. not personally, but I just don't think it would be a good fit.
Okay, so this is the crux of like what I'm always arguing with Neil about, because, and maybe there is no solution. Maybe this is just gonna be miserable for everybody involved. But, did you lose me for a second? Am I back?
Just for a second.
Okay.
You're back. Okay. Just a second.
Okay. So I'm often arguing with Neil about this because so you're from the rural area, I'm from the city, and we're like on the, you know, opposite experiences growing up on this like debate. And I'm wondering if there is any solution that makes sense that's not like going to make everybody miserable. And this is what I'm always constantly trying to figure out with Neil. And he's just like, no, there's not. Go away. I'm here. And I respect that. And he's like, he also makes a good point that, and I'm sure you share this idea. And yeah, I think we exchanged over this, but basically like a city person is going to come in with their own ideas and their own ways of protecting themselves and their own families. And it's going to be probably at odds with what I want to have happen to my like place and community. And I don't begrudge you that that's what you're going to do, but it is going like it will by its nature be destructive to me. I'm like, but I'm from Chicago, the south side of Chicago. And it's like, it's just not a livable place. Like, you know, if I spent my life there trying to make it better, I could be like genuinely putting my whole family at risk in lots of different ways, you know, like just the school system and like everybody who's around and like literal shoot ups and places where we go, you know, this like just so many things that are so screwed up that like you know, maybe if every I got a bunch of people on board to try to make a difference, and or like found a few families to like and just stayed in that little cocoon or whatever. But it would just be like swimming upstream all the time. So I moved to a rural area and I'm like trying in a different country, totally in Uruguay. And I'm trying my best to be like useful and respectful and to like be like a contributing member of the community in a way that's like beneficial to people here, not just like benefiting myself. But like the dynamics are different in the US too. Like, I mean, city people moving to rural areas, like, I think a lot of city people aren't just going to come in with like, how can I be the most like respectful to local norms and this kind of thing? Like, they're not going to be like that. So I'm like, I'm just wondering your thoughts on this. Like,
well, that's fair. And it's, you know, it's easy for me to say, well, my family's been in the eastern part of Connecticut for a long time, or rural New England in general. But, you know, we weren't always here. We started on one side. We came on a boat from Italy in 1918. And then on the other side, my family's French Canadian. And we basically wandered up and down from Quebec to Rhode Island for several hundred years. You know, and we moved into places where there was work. And, you know, we did what was in our best interest. We were very poor. When things were bad in Quebec, we came to New England and vice versa. So we did that. You know, it's not, you know, nothing is so black and white where there's like, this is the right way to do it. And if you're lucky enough, you're in the same town where you've always been for 15 generations and that works out. Yeah. But that's not everybody's situation for sure. And yeah. I understand that. And I think you may be right. Chicago is so broken fundamentally. Maybe you can't live there. And then you got to go somewhere else. And you ultimately do have a responsibility to your kids and to do what you have to do.
I think Neil, like, I think the reason people get so triggered by Neil is because like Neil just doesn't care about other people. Like, what, like, he doesn't care about, like, he's basically just, like, and I think the point he's making, that he's trying to make again and again, that triggers people, is he's like, I'm not trying to do what's good for you. I don't care what you do. Like, he's like, I'm just not on your team. He's like, I'm on, like, a different team. And I think in some sense, it is hard, because Neil has what most people, like, wish they had, which is that, like, he's got a thriving family with, like, cousins all around and, like, they've been there for many generations and they live in like, you know, a nice little town. And he's just like, you're not like you're not my people. And like, I'm going to fight you if you come here. Right. And I think like, I don't know. It's interesting because like so many people get triggered by this. I think that it's something, there's something about like just having your sensibilities be like, people move to a town probably without knowing like anybody in it or and then like they, I think that the issue is people coming in with all these ideas of like what it's going to be like. And it's like, yes, there's like, it's like make opening their little like, you know, their like shishi shops. And
Neil always says, like when they have trivia,
and I don't know,
when they have trivia nights, that's like the sign that the libs have taken over.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, I think that there's a lot of things, but I don't know, like, I think in a sense, like, if you really don't think that you are that thing, then just don't sweat it too much. Like, I don't know, like, we're from a city, we've been living in the country for a while somewhere else, but like, we're moving to a small town or to the country near a small town. And it's like, but you know, I don't sweat it because my husband's a carpenter, you know, he's not like, it's like, he's not, he's like a kind of self, like he's studied with his dad, he's a carpenter.
There's extremes here.
If you're going to move somewhere and like do remote work from that place, and I don't know, that I think I know what Neil's, I understand what Neil's saying. And I think you just like, I don't know. I just think that you cannot be that thing. But there's also a degree to which, like, if you are, he's like, that's okay. But like,
he's not. Enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. Neil also like, obviously is less like hard set than he comes across online. And I think, yeah, I don't know why.
That's a New England thing to be, it's kind of like a hard ass sense of humor and really busting people's balls. And that's what we have in common. That's, you know, the way that we talk to people is probably how our uncles and grandfathers talked to us. And they, you know, yeah, gave us a hard time. It was very, you know, when I was a kid, it was very funny because it was a lot like these Twitter threads. It was my uncles and my grandfather all sitting around with French accents, teasing me until I cried and giving me a hard time and saying things I wanted to do were silly, unrealistic, and teasing me for being soft and that kind of thing. And so that, I imagine he, like me, got it that way, and it's his way of having fun. I don't think it's that personal, but there's a big difference between somebody, you know, it's a free country. We, neither of us can stop. If you buy a house in the country, move to the country, you live in the country. It doesn't matter whether we approve. Whether, you know, and then I think it's a very different thing if you just move there and you're a carpenter and you pay your taxes and your kids go to the school and you want to have a say in what goes on in the school. Then, you know, there was some stuff like early on that it was, you know, someone was saying we should, you know, eliminate the Walmarts, force the people who live there to shop better places by force. They, you know, if peppers cost $9 each at the farmer's market, they can learn to spend better and save their money. That's like, that is really, that kind of stuff is really what we were pushing back on that. And it was just like this, you know, we're just so certain that our project is noble that that's justified. And we're kind of, and so we were probably a little aggressive in trying to be a counterpoint to that, but it is important to know that not everyone is going to, you're not going to walk in and say that stuff and have everyone greet with open arms, especially if they've been there a long time.
Yeah.
You're not going to walk into the, your town meeting and make these speeches and have everyone clap for you.
I've got to run. I think my baby's getting up. Just wanted to pop in for a moment there, but thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
It was nice talking to you.
Having me for a minute.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, bye. Thanks, Willow. So many of the people who are like attracted to my Twitter account are people who are like urban or suburban disaffected, who like want a meaningful life. And a lot of people are not under the illusion that they're like part of something, some amazing, I don't know, social movement. They're just like, they just want a nice life for themselves. And they think a nice way to do it is to like get away from the cities, because the cities are like objectively difficult to thrive in the US especially, but other places too. And so like you, from being on the receiving end of this gentrification maybe, or just people moving out of the cities, like what do you say to those people? Like what would you say if they're like genuinely want to be a good neighbor or like respectful and not mess things up? Like what do they do?
Well, this is not probably a satisfying or cool answer for a lot of people, but I think a lot of these people, what they actually want to do is live in the suburbs. I think they want to live in the suburbs. I think is what they actually want. And I don't think the suburbs is a very attractive or fashionable thing to strive towards. But if you just want to have six or a dozen chickens and have a garden and not live in the middle of chaos and you know, be set back a little bit from the strip malls and all that, I think that's a reasonable answer for a lot of people. Yeah, and that's something maybe people should consider more. I think you can have a community in those places, and I think they don't have a lot of the problems. And I'm not saying that absolutely nobody should move to a rural area, but I don't think that gets examined enough. And I think it realistically, for what, you know, if you're working a full-time job, you don't have time to homestead and run a farm. It's a lot of work. My wife doesn't work at all. You know, we make just enough to get by. It's, you know, we don't have a very glamorous existence. We do a lot of stuff so she can be home with the kids and do this stuff. But, and then she's, you know, it's constantly trying to supplement, because I just don't have a lot of money for food. You know, I shop at Walmart because I have to shop at Walmart. Yeah. If I had to go to the farmer's market, we'd be having a rough time. We'd be eating rice every night.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I actually think that's a really useful thing. I teach this I organize this homesteading 101 class. And one thing that a lot of people who are like curious about some kind of self-production, like maybe slightly more meaningful life than just like consumerism and, you know, working your white collar job or whatever, a lot of people have come to that conclusion. Like maybe it is just a tiny bit of land in the suburbs that I'm looking for, like in some fruit trees and some chickens and like out of the worst of the like city chaos and just some green space. And I do think like probably people's impulse might be slightly too extreme to go fully rural. And that might be an extreme thing for them too, like because they're not used to it. And then there's all these examples of people moving rural and then moving immediately back. Like during the pandemic, I guess like all these people move rural and then they go back. They're like, they want it. They don't want to give up like Uber Eats or whatever.
Either that or you end up with a lot. You had a lot of these farms that are just, you know, they just bit off more than they can chew. And it's that, you know, Neil's talked about with like the garbage everywhere. They buy like cheap plastic fencing and they're just scrambling to do something that they're not prepared to do. And it looks like hell and it's disorganized and it falls apart and goes into disrepair. Like, because like we said, it is a lot of work.
And it's so different. Like you have none of the skills. The main thing for me is like, I really do want to gain these skills, but like, I don't do any more. I don't like try to make my project any bigger than I can handle at any one moment. Like just very slowly adding skills and learning how to do things as opposed to like, I think a lot of people are like, I'm going to move rural and like start a vegetable CSA. And it's like, you don't know anything. Don't start by like trying to have a business and like, it's going to be so much work for you. Yeah. So that's good. And then what about, okay. So say they do move rural though. They don't listen to the suburbs advice. Neil has said a couple specific things like, let people hunt on your land.
Yeah. It's generally, you know, you have to be reasonable because yes, you do carry insurance and you're liable for stuff. And that, so I understand the instinct to come post, but it's generally bad form. If you buy like 15 acres, you're using three of them and somebody's been multiple generations has been like going through the back of your lot, fishing or hunting or whatever. If you just come into the town and you post, that's not, I could say it's not a good vibe. If people take offense to that, you know, that happened. The town that we live in now, where we bought a house, is only a couple towns over from where I grew up. But you know, we're still not from this town in particular. So when we moved here, there's people who, you know, there's a street behind us that's very poor and they don't have a lot of land, and they've always just kind of crept onto our land to fish and all that. And so when we got here, my wife was initially very anxious. She wanted to just post everywhere and was like, we're going to get sued if they get hurt. And so we kind of had to work, you know, when we catch people, we say, listen, it's cool. Just come up and shout at us and tell us that you're here. So we know you're on our land.
Yeah.
And I think that went over better. You know, how that works in real life, I'm not going to tell somebody, let people do whatever you want on your land because I'm not the one getting sued.
Right, right.
But things do work different. And like things, you know, it's a lot of these towns, stuff still works on a handshake. Your word is your word. People aren't inclined to sue each other. It doesn't mean that you can automatically trust everybody because some people just moved to the town too. You know, you don't know who everybody is, but I think that's what he was getting at.
Yeah. And I think like, well, at least in my case, my instinct has been to just listen a lot and ask a lot of questions before like telling anybody how to do anything. My kids go to this little rural school and all the parents like run the school. We all get together at meetings and like, you know, talk about how things are supposed to go and like do fundraisers and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm like, it's in Spanish too, which adds another layer of complexity if there's like things and nuance that I don't get. But there was a couple of points where they were like, you know, what do you think? And I was like, I literally don't want, it would be stupid of me to express any opinion. Like there's just too much I don't know that I don't have to weigh in on this. And I just think like probably a lot of urban people are used to thinking that their opinion is like necessary and important at all points and their way of doing things, as opposed to like maybe being a little humble about you being in a new social context. You gotta like be respectful of how people do things and learn first before you start saying how things should be done.
I think coming into this from Twitter too, where Twitter is very take oriented and everyone's timeline is their little kingdom where they have their takes. And so I think people getting excited about these ideas in Twitter and that being their approach to everything probably amplifies that, because you go in and then you're like, well, it's my turn to have my take, and it's not necessarily your turn.
Yeah, and I think like the takeaway for me is like it's just going to be complicated there are a lot of rural towns that are kind of hollowed out and could be positively impacted from people moving there. But it depends on what they do with it and how much they're like respectful of the like local norms. Of course, you can't always go back, but it might be nice to like have some continuity and not bring your whole ideas in and to try to keep the character of a place. That's at least what I'm going to advocate for when people, you know, come to me and ask me about this stuff. And you know, I'm not going to control very much, but at least that's going to be my message. Now I want to talk about your whole journey with Catholicism. Talk us through like what, sure, how it was growing up. And then I know you got into the punk scene for a while. What was that like?
So it's, you know, in general, not just with Catholicism, but with everything, I kind of have, it feels like the inverse of what, just at a glance, I haven't been able to dig in deep, but a lot of the guests and people in this circle who you have on come from the other world and dip into this one, where to me, it's the opposite thing. I dipped into that world as a teenager. Mm. So we, you know, like I said, my one side of my family came over on a boat from Italy to work in factories. The other side were lumberjacks who were just kind of traveled, and they were originally from Quebec, and they worked their way down. My wife's family are what you call swamp Yankees, who are mostly the poor Irish stock who came here as indentured servants when the area was colonized, and they were subsistence farmers and indentured servants.
Before you move on, what is a swamp Yankee? I've heard Neil use this. I've heard anarcho-contrarian use it. Like, what defines a swamp Yankee?
There's some dispute over where the term comes from, but it's basically, it's more southern New England, eastern Connecticut, western Rhode Island, some, you know, the rural parts of Massachusetts. It's referring to people who live on the land that was less desirable. So
okay,
you have two real old stocks. You have your Mayflower descendants, your WASP, your kind of the Brahmins of Boston and those people. And then you have the people who lived in, you know, there are hicks, our rednecks, and those are people who are, you know, they're known for their ingenuity, but kind of, you know, jury rigging together, you know, your tractor breaks and you put it together with zip ties and that kind of, that's my wife's family. We're not farmers. We never farmed. We were people who would keep chickens and pigs and know how to make wine and stuff, but nothing that, we were never on the same land for a lot of generations, so we didn't do stuff like that. We would just, stuff that we could set up in a year or two.
Yeah,
and that's how we lived, as opposed to where her side, you would be on this crappy, rocky, swampy piece of land, and you'd figure out what you could make work. Hmm. And that's, so there were really two different kind of people just getting by, and until we met and married, but we were from different stock. But so that's the bigger point was then, you know, so I grew up with my grandparents both having been in that old world, and my parents were like boomer, wannabe hippie strivers who were, you know, their aspiration was to be better than where they were from. So I grew up very much kind of like a nihilistic Gen X kid, got into the, you know, the punk rock stuff was very attractive to me. I didn't really have any interest in where I was from. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to get a graduate degree. I wanted to hang out with those kids. I was into left anarchism and Noam Chomsky and all that crap. And I just flamed out because I didn't fit in that world. You know, I didn't know the social norms, and a lot of people would say they wanted revolution but weren't actually going to do anything. And I was a stupid, reckless kid who at the protest would actually get arrested because I'd be like, hey, we're not going to be a wuss, let's do this. So because I was a dumb hazy, basically. So I got in trouble being in that world, and that backfired badly for me and kind of humbled me. And I ended up, you know, I was in my early 20s, had a kid I didn't plan, and had to work in blue collar jobs and humble myself. And as far as becoming religious, that was just a natural byproduct of having kids and struggling and needing something. And what I knew was my grandparents' faith. And that's, so I just found that, and it wasn't, never like I'm going to get into this. This is going to make, you know, this is the right way to return or anything like that for me. It was familiar.
Yeah. When you said you got in trouble, was it like, were the consequences different for you because you weren't from these like more white collar backgrounds? Is that part of the story or not really?
I think if I had been a little better connected to these circles in the, the anarchist kids who were all in grad school and more intellectual, I think I would have less consequences, and I also would have had people telling me when to pump the brakes and know when it was, yeah, we're saying revolution, but you don't actually go do some this stupid thing because we want to keep our jobs. We
Yeah.
want, the goal is to make tenure someday. They were all talking like violent revolutionaries, but that's not actually what they were doing. It's a put on. And I was too naive to get that part of it. And I was very gung ho about it. And I guess
Yeah.
that's where I got in trouble.
Yeah, I'm thinking of people. So I grew up like a working class family. My dad's a fireman, was a fireman, retired firefighter in Chicago, and I got a scholarship to college, so I got to go to a fancy school, University of Chicago, and like I got around some of these people who I like knew the details of some of their lives, where they like got into some really illegal stuff and just like there was the, and just pulled strings to get out of it, totally pulled strings, like didn't have any consequences at all, and like really bad stuff, and they, you know, the language of the parents was like, you don't want to ruin this kid's life. It's like,
Yeah.
okay, you know, oh, all right, I guess they get that choice.
And that was something that really flared up in the 90s around like animal liberation, earth liberation. A lot of kids did go to federal prison. Janet Reno kind of did a sweep out of the and broke those groups up. But that was really just a continuation of stuff that had gone on since the 60s. There had been a lot of minor left wing terrorism, like the Weathermen and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And like that guy who's a DA in San Francisco now, his parents are terrorists who bomb people, and they did enough that they eventually had to face the consequences. But a lot of it was rich kids were connected, and they got pardoned after a while or whatever, and they didn't really face consequences for it. And there was a reluctance to really to get go too hard after that kind of stuff because they were, I'd say the people were overall sympathetic to the culture was it was pushing that direction, and they were just too strident. Why ruin their lives? And I think the 90s was just another iteration of that.
Yeah. So what is your take? So you like came from this world, dipped into the other world, and are like back to your roots. What is your take on I think maybe similar to homesteading, it's like a similar thing. You know, you kind of just have this background that you can fall back into that like people who grew up, let's say like in cities or liberal or without religion, like want are like striving for. I just have to read this tweet out loud because I saved it for this conversation. It said, I just racked 20-ish bottles of autumn olive wine, some autumn olive cordials, rhubarb cordials, dandelion working, and the first batch of wine grapes should be ready when that's done. I'm like, this is like everybody's dream. And I think like truly belonging to religion and feeling comfortable in it is also kind of the goal for people. And I think similar to our conversation earlier, like there's just people who are like LARPing it and faking it or just trying to be cool with it, and are doing it in an unhealthy way. And then there are people who are like genuinely seeking meaning. So like I wonder what your take is on this. I'm sure you're noticing these trends too.
Yeah, it's odd to me because I think what I'm basically doing is not having a lot of money and walking around in my yard and like, oh, this grows here. It's cost cutting. It's trying to find, autumn olives are a weed, so I'm gonna get 20 bottles of wine out of it, and that's $200 of cheap wine that I don't have to buy. So if you want to have creature comforts, just somebody who's living paycheck to paycheck, you would do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that was something my grandfather did when he came over from Italy. He worked for a factory. He was given a house as part of his arrangement for leaving his country, but it was a very small house with a small yard. So he learned how to, he grew wine on his fence, he grapes, and he kept figs in a bucket, and he brought them inside for the winter.
Yeah.
And so he could have those creature comforts because he didn't have the space or the means to have them otherwise. And so it's a little bit confusing to me that what I basically see is my grandparents' old habits from being poor, being romanticized. But I've kind of gotten it as I've talked to you. There is, as much as I see where we came from as being hard, it's different. Everyone has their own struggle, And I can't say I envy people who live in this world where you're under a microscope and you have to, you know, you always have to be on and kind of toe the line and not say the wrong thing. Because if you're, you know, academics, I get was my job for saying the wrong thing. I just get the next head chef job. It may not be ideal, but I'll be making the same amount of money and move on with my life.
Yeah.
If you get exiled from academia over a scandal, I imagine it's a lot harder to restart.
Yeah.
So I understand the appeal of this life where you're not have under that kind of pressure, and I can just say whatever stupid thing I want, and the worst thing I have to do is say, my bad, I shouldn't have said that. And that's it.
And I would just add from like the homesteading side, it's like you live in a city your whole life and increasingly you know, my dad worked, you know, not just as a fireman but as a roofer to like have enough extra money so we could go on like vacations as a family, stuff like that. We never had to produce any food or anything like that in the city, so it is a different level, but of like middle class striving. But there is also something where like as the people around me and the people I grew up with became more affluent, it's like there's a kind of emptiness to it. Like your whole life, like I mean, most of my peers now who have like done decently well for themselves, like their whole lives are just about like having a bigger house to show off, nice fancier suburbs to live in, bigger cars, like, you know, so there is a sense where you just like want to feel like there's I don't know, some striving in life that's meaningful. Some like actual striving, like learn actual skills and to do something that's like you can actually fail at, like, you know, you can actually fail at producing taking care of chickens, and then that failure is like almost like you just want to feel more alive, like so much of life is just like hi, is like, you know, just buying things, you know, and that's it,
Yeah,
that's your
and
whole
that's what
existence.
I am a little wary of the collapse stuff, you know. And I don't even my wife and I don't agree on this completely. She's a little more of a prepper type, and she's motivated somewhat by anxiety about where things are going and wanting to be ready to survive it and that sort of thing. You have to excuse me. He
Oh
left.
no, you're fine. This happens a lot on this
Yeah.
podcast, actually.
But so I'm not motivated by that stuff so much. I think, you know, frankly, there was a collapse. Would I do better than people in the city? Probably. But, you know, if things got really ugly and like the state is going door to door, what's the difference between me and someone in the city? We might last 5 minutes shooting it out before we die the same way. I think that's a very ugly possibility to dwell on. And I kind of feel powerless about it, like anybody else would.
Yeah.
And to me, it's more about, you know, you can sit indoors and watch Netflix, or you can go outside and do something with your kids where you're active, you're not being sedentary. And a lot of the stuff I'm doing, you know, it's a way to connect. I'm using like making dandelion wine with my grandfather's recipe. That's not solving any big social problems. I'm not trying to solve climate change, but it's a nice way to stay connected to things. It's a good way to spend my time, and you only have so much time. I can spend it doing stuff like that, or I can spend it watching Stranger Things.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And like that's exactly, I mean, I think that's like what I share, and I think the people who are with who follow like who follow Neil like get that sense too. And you know, I think basically you're searching for I don't know, just like a more meaningful existence and one that where like doing something is I don't know. I don't know. I'm not articulating it well, but I just feel like, you know, just like being active in your kids' lives, hanging around, being outside, doing things outdoors, like all of that kind of stuff, which is kind of impossible in cities and impossible with like white collar jobs.
And it's, yeah, and I really think about, you know, I have kids from 19 to 5. And so I'm getting to the point where my kids are graduating, one's moved out. And you think about that stuff a lot. And that time goes by really fast. And there was someone said this on Twitter. I can't find the tweet, and I've been dying to, but it's stuck with me. And it's very appropriate that I can't find it, actually, because it said, raising kids is like standing on a grate and it's raining precious gems or diamonds or whatever, and you're trying to catch them in your hands, but they're just slipping through your fingers. And at the end, you can't hold on to anything more than a handful, and it all just slips away. But in the moment, it's very beautiful. And that's how it feels having kids. This goes by so fast, and even if your kids are do well and they're successful, it's going to be over, and it's going to be over fast. And it's just about how you spend that time. And ultimately, this stuff is it just makes better memories and a better way to spend that time to me.
Yeah, I honestly like the kids, the raising kids part is the was the primary motivator for me at least to like move my whole family across the world, which is it was really important to me. I worked for these rich families where they had nannies and I was a nanny and they had like more than one nanny and they would be going to work from like 6 a.m. till 7 or 8 p.m. And it was like, I don't want this. You know, it doesn't matter how big my house is. I don't want this. Like, I want, if I'm going to have kids, I'm going to raise them. I'm going to be around. And I don't care how poor I am. I'm going to find a way to do that. Like, and
Oh.
so just like finding a way to set my whole life up around that was the goal for me before having kids.
That was a big factor for us. You know, obviously we weren't wealthy, but I was early in my career, I was working 70 to 80 hour weeks. My daughter would stay up to midnight so she could see me before bed. And then I would take her to the bus stop and see her for 10 minutes before then. And then I'd be gone all day. You know, back then we were both working at least part time. And so that's, and those years just blow by, and there's, you just have these little moments that were good. And it's, you know, the way that we live now is, you know, we're kind of trading off. I could probably do better financially. I could get a corporate chef job or something and move up a little in class, but I would be sacrificing that. And I regret it with my early kids. I wish that I had been home more.
Yeah. So back to the Catholicism question, like, what is your take on people who are newly coming to it? And like, I don't know. I personally, so I grew up like going to a Lutheran church when I was little, and then I went to a Catholic high school, all girls Catholic school, which was fun. And it was actually great. I mean, it was a great experience going to a Catholic school. It was really nice to have that. Social cohesion, you know, like cultural cohesion in high school. And we also had retreats as a part of you know, the Catholic school, and that was r like really was a nice experience as opposed to like what my life would have been like if I went to a public school, you know, socially, I would say at least. And I don't know, but then I see some people, I'm interested in religion. I kind of just like never was too serious about it even growing up, and neither my parents weren't either really. It was just kind of like something we did, but nobody was really serious, too serious about it. But then now I see people like getting into Catholicism in like some almost like hardcore way. And to me it's like almost shocking, like, you know, maybe it shouldn't be so self-conscious. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
sometimes people are doing it, and like a lot of this stuff, like homesteading and religion and all this stuff, like it almost feels like people are so self-conscious coming to it and like showing off that they're doing it. And I remember there was this one interaction I had with Neil. Sorry, I'm no, you want to say something? Where
No, go
there
ahead.
was like some guy, there was some woman posting homesteading pictures of herself, and she was like obviously super wealthy. And he was like, this is horrible. Like, this is so stupid. Like, if you don't denounce this in the strongest possible terms, like you have to. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I guess it's not as bad as some other things rich people could be doing. And he's like, no, it's like, it's so fake. And that's what I hate about it. It's so like showing off, like everything is super expensive. You're not actually homesteading at all, blah, blah, blah. So I feel like I do share a kind of skepticism though, where people are like, extremely self-consciously doing it and showing off that they're doing it, and then that like makes me feel like they're just doing it to fit in as opposed to like because it's inherently meaningful.
Yeah, and I mean, I do believe, I mean, you can fall into something for the wrong reason and it still be the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So I am reluctant to attack people when they're trying to find meaning, and it's a natural thing when you convert to be very earnest about it and say things that are embarrassing. And there's been a lot of people, because I do art that I share online, that's kind of, that is, you know, it's driven by Catholicism, that people have come to me and said that was part of why they converted. And I don't want to tell people, don't, you know, don't do that, you're fake. But, you know, then those people have also had moments where they, you know, there's one friend I have in particular who, he, you know, he stopped, he became celibate. He was gay and he was very, very politically active in the left. And when he jumped into it, he became very, very strident, and he got into some, you know, public heat, and his priest got in trouble because he was being very publicly strident. And but we also talked about it. He's like, you know, I had a convert moment. He said, I kind of embarrassed myself in my church. And that, you know, that's, maybe that's part of it. Maybe that's how you fall into it. It's hard. it's hard for me to relate to that on one level because I don't even know when my family became Catholic. It probably happened when Rome was converted. But so it's like beyond the historical record. So it's very easy for me to just say that's just what I am. But yeah. I had to come into practice later in life because I was someone who had gone to church like once or twice a year with my grandparents. I wasn't devout at all. It was just in the background. But I think it's dangerous to politicize it. I don't think that's what it's about. It's really Catholicism in particular is a way to make meaning out of suffering. And that's really the core of it. And so, you know, for me, if I wanted to know why was it important to my grandparents, it's because my great uncle drowned to death on a log drive when he was 18. My great grandfather killed himself because his last kid left home. My sister died in the crib when she was 2 months old. My grandfather died when my dad was only 12. And that's why my grandparents went to church. They were suffering, you know, and when I came to it, it was very much because I was overwhelmed and life didn't go how I planned it. And I needed something to deal with it. And I was terrified of what was, you know, I saw what happened with me and how I drifted away from my grandparents. Some of them died before I made things right. And I didn't want my kids to go through things the same way. I didn't want them to be 18 or 19 figuring things out. And this was a way to how I understood meaning in life. And that was so, but again, because I was born with it, there wasn't this big process of figuring out what's right. And it wasn't intellectual for me. And I don't have a lot of good answers for that. I can't pretend to.
No. And you know, and yeah, I mean, the other thing that is like weird about this podcast in general is that a lot of people are trying to like seek something meaningful and it's hard to talk about on a podcast. Like a lot of it is just like, it feels right. It feels like more meaningful, you know, and it's even hard to describe. And I think sometimes in some cases too, it's like not even necessary to describe. It's just something I'm doing and modeling. Okay, so last question from me is I'm wondering about Holy Agony. Like, what is the origin story of that? And it's so good. I feel like there's no good art, and it's so good. It's so beautiful, and I'm not even like, you know, like I said, not super, I'm not definitely not practicing religious, but certainly empathetic towards it, sympathetic, but it's just so beautiful, and like, I think making meaning of suffering, it's like, I don't know, it's like the whole human experience, like everything about it is so lovely. So tell me about like what drove you to make that, and then what's it gonna turn into?
So I had started, when I started, around the time I was falling into right-wing Twitter by default, it wasn't a very artful place at the time, unless you count like Pepe memes. So I had started making these, they were just visual at the time. The project was called Tradwave, which was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but taken seriously later. But it was just taking like the vaporwave stuff, and I was like going around taking pictures of old churches and editing them into that style. A lot of it was original stuff. I was just driving around New England and taking pictures of statues. I didn't really have any driving idea or intent. It was a creative outlet. I couldn't play in bands anymore. At that point, I'd been canceled out of that. I didn't really want to be in a punk scene, and I didn't really have any other outlet. But I'd always been a musician. So after a year or two at Tradwave, I had this big audience of people who were basically just saw it as a meme page, and I kind of took advantage and started making music. And music online is very disposable. So you just put up a Bandcamp and somebody cares about it for a week. So I, at some point, saw some of the stuff that was going on in the circle of Twitter I was in, where it was being framed as a podcast. And I said, well, what if I just made, you know, the music and skewed it a little more towards the storytelling side and released it as a podcast? And that's what we did. For about a year. It helped. It was during COVID, so it was, you know, I never stopped working or did anything during that time, but it was, as I've talked about elsewhere, it was very rough being in the nonprofit sector during that. And I was seeing it firsthand, was skeptical early on, and didn't really have anywhere to talk about that, because that was one thing where I would, you know, you couldn't talk about that at work. It just wasn't acceptable.
Yeah.
So initially the first episode was kind of airing that stuff out. And then I just had these personal stories and stuff that came out, and we we did about, you know, six episodes, and then my creative partner just hasn't been able to commit, so I started doing solo stuff. And we, and after, you know, just recently, I think we, I've decided, you know, we're, I want to move on and do my own stuff. So, and I don't really feel right doing Holy Agony without the, without Jess, who was involved. So I am working now on something. It's gonna be similar, just a little smaller in scale. The name I'm working with now is Cathedral in the Pines, which is just a local. It's actually two different local locations. One's an actual church outside, and one is just a place with really tall pine trees. But it's New England based, and I think it's just gonna be kind of more of the same with a little smaller scale.
And to, for people who haven't heard Holy Agony, it's like music and like historical audio cut up with people's stories.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you listen to AM or college radio in the 90s, back when things were a little weirder, a lot of it's informed by that. The idea of having people on Twitter do monologues, obviously Ghost Jail pioneered that, and that was a big influence on that part of it. But you know, some episodes we didn't have any guests at all, and it was just kind of a format where it's not just talking, because I don't think anyone wants to listen to me talk for an hour. I mean, people keep inviting me on these things, but I don't feel like I'm that important.
I don't know. There is like, I think that the truth is that there's probably a lot of guys like you and probably people like me, but they're just not on Twitter. So then people are like, wow, we really got to get this guy's perspective. But it's like, you know, we're just like, you're like representative of like a working class guy who's just annoyed by a lot of what's happening on Twitter and not afraid to say it, which is useful, I think. Useful. Oh, did I go away?
I lost you for 1 second.
Okay, yeah, I was just saying a working class guy who's like obviously annoyed by a lot of things that are happening on Twitter and not afraid to say it. So people are like, yeah, we definitely need that perspective, and we do. Yeah.
And to be fair, I do see myself as a normal guy, and I play up a little bit, but I do have, I think me and Neil both, because we're not just normal guys, and we have dipped the toe in the other world, and we have a little bit of a perspective from having seen both sides and been a little more artistically inclined despite our backgrounds. So I do have, you know, that's something that's a little different, and why I'm able to poke my nose in a little bit. I, you know, a real normal guy probably would not listen to my podcast or any podcast.
Exactly. And I would also just venture to say that your trolling and Neil's trolling is like a work of art. It's so good. I remember you, I sent you this, but you had a tweet where you're like responding to some guy, and it's like, you know, a guy of your stature shouldn't be like so bothered about me, you know? And it's just so, it's such a great troll. It's like, why do you care? Why, if I'm just like some person who doesn't matter, why are you getting so like upset about the things that I'm saying? But on Twitter, you can have that power over people, which is actually great.
And I think it's ultimately, it's bigger than me. It's bigger than Neil. We're just guys saying this stuff, but I think the only reason it resonates is because there's some truth to it, and it forces them to acknowledge there's a world outside of the LARP, or the even if it's not a LARP, the discourse on Twitter.
Yeah.
And Twitter doesn't let you edit that out. It, you know, if people say something, it's in there, and so they have to respond to it.
Yeah.
I think that's why people get frustrated. It's because they can't shut up the parts that they don't want in it. Canada,
which is good. Yeah, exactly. Just briefly back to Holy Agony, like you have these themes for these episodes, and they're they convey this, like, I don't, again, it's hard to describe, but it's like really deep meaning of, you know, whatever the theme is, via story and sound. And a lot of it is like some of the audio is like illegible, like you don't know where it's coming from, you don't know where, like, what the audio is from or whatever, but put all together, it just gives you such a, you know, like art is supposed to do, it makes you feel something really strong at the end. And I just want to like say it's so good, and I congratulate you on that. So will the new one be New England themed, or will it be about Catholicism or both, or you don't know what yet?
Well, I know that the first episode I'm working on is specifically about, you know, it's rotating around the stuff I've been talking about with my daughter graduating and that thread I did about the punk scene and how I felt like it was supposed to be like an intentional community, but it really just severed my ties from my family for a while. And that, so it's going to be about around those themes. I don't think it's going to be a big difference. I just, because it's just me and my other partner was not from New England, you know, Jess is from the Midwest. So it was less specific and it was more the places, things we have in common, where if it's just me talking, it's going to naturally gravitate towards the stuff that I live, which is New England.
Yeah.
I can't talk and not have Catholicism be in it. So I'm sure it will be. I'm not going to, Holy Agony was released episodes around the liturgical calendar, which was, it was a good device for keeping us on schedule and making us focus on things, but it was stressful. And I think I'm not going to be that tied to it just because it makes it a lot harder to produce. And you're doing something like that and knowing you absolutely have to be done in 2 weeks or else.
Right.
It was useful for a collaboration, but I think I'd like to be a little more casual.
Yeah. And just like, yeah, release it when you can. The last thing I'll say is that thread you had about the, like, going into the punk scene, like, honestly, I almost feel like this is pretty central. Like, we talked about it before, but this is really central to, like, I think a lot of the arc of people, like, drawn to doomer optimism generally, and a lot of people, like, trying to figure things out and not becoming strange or, like, LARPing or, like, having some other psychosis come about, like, in your solution to the problems. But it is, like, there is something about the way you describe the punk scene is like, there is something fundamentally fundamental about modernity in that journey that you went through that I think a lot of people go through, which is like, go away from anything meaningful, sever ties, like don't care about relationships at all. Don't care about the place you're from. Don't care. Like everything, you should just seek out everything that's new or the new, and everything has to be novel all the time. Otherwise it's not interesting. And like, it's like this breakneck pace where like anything that's considered out of date at all has to get thrown away. And like, that just is a recipe for disaster. And that's why so many people are suffering. Genuinely, that's what I feel like. There's just almost nothing grounding people because the next thing is always, there's always something new. Like everything is novel and we're just inventing things. We're inventing words. We're inventing ways to speak. Like there's nothing grounding you. There's nothing like genuinely meaningful. So, I mean, fundamentally, I think that's what is like behind what a lot of people are seeking is like just any sense of like connection, meaning, belonging, like reality.
Yeah, and I think that's what it's important. A lot of people look at it, they use the, you know, return gets thrown around almost like a joke, but I don't think you can't return because that's not how time works. And I like to look at it more as you're moving forward whether you want to or not. You're going to get old. You're going to have kids. They're going to get old. You're going to die. You'll be remembered or not, but eventually you won't be. And it's more about there's a thread that's intact where in a real culture or a folk culture, these things are your grandparents were connected to them, you are, and your kids will be, and their kids will be, and you're just trying to maintain a thread where the function of a counterculture doesn't really matter what it is, because I see a lot of similarity in the left leaning anarchist punk stuff to the right wing stuff now.
Yeah,
if you're disowning your grandfather, it doesn't matter whether it's because he's racist or because he's a neocon, you're still disowning your grandfather. And you're severing a tie and you're going into a weird space divorced from your reality and your family. And that's what this stuff does. And there's, you know, there's a cost to this. There's a spiritual human cost. For me, it was, I got sucked into this stuff. And when my grandfather died, I went to him. I was escorted by county jail guards in handcuffs. And the last time I spoke to him was on a payphone in jail. Mm. He was disappointed with me. We never sorted things out. And he remembered me as a disappointment and involved in some weird political stuff he disapproved of and lazy. And that, you know, that's how he saw me. And then I had to square with that in handcuffs at a funeral home alone with a guard standing over my shoulder.
Yeah.
And that's, and that everything's not that dramatic. Some people, it may be much quieter, and you may just not speak to your parents and get weird and live in your apartment on the other side of the country, and then they die and you go to the funeral. But yeah, you're gonna have that moment if you don't maintain the threads.
Yeah. I mean, just briefly, I'll say from like a woman's perspective, a lot of the novelty with regard to women, it involves like never seeing your kids, and like I just feel like there's so much damage being done by that, where you're just like, there's just a lot that's not being spoken about how, the damage is happening to families when our whole structures are set up like that. But anyways, okay. So, any last thoughts
just to end on a happier note, I guess it just occurred to me while he's playing this kid's name is Emil. That's my grandfather's name. Mm. And so, in some way, that was healed and I made right on it. And I feel good about the fact that when I'm gone, he's going to be explaining to kids or grandkids why he's named Emil, and he's going to know things about this person who died. And it's right, it rights the wrong, and that thread will keep going. So it's not hopeless. And as bad as it got, and it got pretty bad in my case, there's stuff you can do to fix it.
Yeah, totally. Okay, cool. Well, Emil, I'll give you your dad back. Thank you, John. It was so nice talking. And yeah, we'll see you on Twitter.
This is great. Thanks. It was nice.
I'll see you at the next Twitter battle.
Okay. Bye. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.